Hey, welcome to today's SaaS Unbound show. Today I'm joined by Dave Boyce, Harvard grad, SaaS veteran, advisor, and now part of Winning by Design. He has helped scale and sell multiple companies, and he just released his new book called Freemium, along with his Substack product-led GTM. So Dave is all in on PLG and AI-assisted GTM, and now the big question on everyone's mind, how AI is reshaping our go-to-market. So we are going to talk about when founders should add sales, how to rethink freemium in the age of AI, what happens when organic search volume declines, and why empathy might be the one thing AI can't replace. Dave, great to have you here. Let's jump in.
Wow, what an intro, Tim. You think we can get all that done?
Yeah, I think so. We can both speak quick.
There you go.
Yeah, tell us, how did you end up founding your first company? How did you end up in SaaS?
Well, that goes back a long time. I'm old, Tim. I'm 57, but I'm an entrepreneur at heart, young at heart. And, you know, when I was in business school in 1999 and 2000, so that was the heart of like the internet kind of bubble. We had, you know, everything.com, right? pets.com and, Epiphany was big, amazing, it was an amazing time. And so during business school, we founded two companies. I would leave class. I would go to the office. We raised a little bit of money on our first one. I'd go to our offices in downtown Boston. We had recruited engineers from Duke who had quit school and moved to Boston to build a company. Actually, it was the other way around. They recruited us. Like they wanted to build this company. We joined forces. We built a company. We raised money. We figured we were too late in that space. We shut it down. We founded another one. This is all inside of 18 months. That other one got good traction. We were in the final kind of investment committee stages of raising money from, I remember sitting in the investment committee at Matrix Partners, and only half of the investment committee was there because it was April 15th, 2000, which was the day that the internet bubble crashed, like the initial crash. So half of the investment committee was trying to triage their portfolio. The other half were distracted on their Blackberries, and we weren't able to raise money on that company. So then I went and joined a startup that was raising money also from the same investors I was raising money from. But they had enough traction that we could move. That company was called ProfitLogic. We ended up building that one and selling it to Oracle. So
was it a SaaS?
SaaS, yeah, it was SaaS. And these other two were SaaS too. They weren't .com. They were SaaS. You know, I was always interested, Tim, in the enterprise side. I don't know why. It made less sense. The B2C at the time just made less sense to me. It makes more sense now, but at the time it was all about eyeballs.
So PLG was not on the horizon back then?
No, not at all. I mean, no, not at all, Tim. Go ahead.
Do you remember when you heard the term the first time then throughout all your years in SaaS?
Well, when we talked enterprise software back then, this is in the early 2000s, we're thinking SAP and Oracle, right? But then here comes, then we start seeing billboards for this thing called Salesforce.com. Here's a B2C concept, which is .com, attached to a B2B concept, which is CRM. And we're thinking wait a minute, is that kind of like Siebel? Is that what is it? So that's and the cloud was kind of not necessarily a word, and SaaS was not necessarily a word, but all of that stuff was coming, right? And so mushing kind of enterprise software and B2C together just started. And then when, I ended up leaving Oracle after we sold that company and founding a company called Fundly, and we moved that company from Boston to Silicon Valley. So this is 2010. So we're a few years later now. So now the cloud's happened, now SaaS has happened, and I land in Silicon Valley. this all probably sounds like ancient history to everyone who's listening, but everything in Silicon Valley was being done differently. Like nobody cared about Oracle. I couldn't even mention Oracle when I was fundraising. Nobody cared about Harvard. Like, who cares about that? Like, what we really want is an engineering founder who's dropped out of Stanford, couldn't care about getting their degree, and is building everything on a self-service basis. So this is the time of like Zendesk and Twilio and Dropbox and kind of all these, what we now know as PLG pioneers, who are literally figuring out how to build self-service acquisition, activation, monetization. They didn't have all those words. PLG wasn't necessarily a word, but we were talking about the consumerization of enterprise software. We're talking about self-service. And the company that I built in Silicon Valley, almost of necessity, we had to build it that way. And that's when I first kind of started embracing, figuring out how to do this in a non-sales-led way.
Wow. Yeah, there was a time where I was still in school, didn't right. have even an idea about software and tech at all. But I think a lot has happened in the meantime. I think now in San Francisco and in Silicon Valley, the AI wave is maybe even partly comparable with what was happening back then when basically the cloud tools came out. So now you're not running a company on your own, but rather you joined an advisory and research company. So tell us about Winning by Design. So what are you doing there now?
Yeah. Well, you know, my path, I'm having a ton of fun, Tim. Like, I love running companies. I love people who run companies. I love the challenge of running a company and navigating kind of the changes like you're talking about. There was kind of e-commerce and then cloud, and then I view PLG as kind of a piece of that cloud stuff, and now AI. Love it, love it, love it. But we sold Inside Sales in 2021, and kind of I lifted my head up and just kind of like was like, what are we going to do next? What do I want to do next? And I really believed that the future of software belongs to self-service. And at the time in my own head, I'm like, future of software belongs to PLG. So I just saw all the trends going that way, Tim, like just making it easy, making software easier to buy, making software easier to use, taking kind of human labor out of each of those processes. Like, onboarding shouldn't be laborious. Like, usage shouldn't be laborious. I shouldn't need humans to train me on how to use a new product. And all of our consumer lives, we never have that. Like, we learn how to use Netflix at the time, Facebook, and we learned to use it all on our own. And so why would that be true for software? So anyway, I called Jocko van der Kooi, who's the founder of Winning by Design. I'm like, what are you doing about PLGs? Like, why do you ask? I'm like, I think the future belongs to PLGs. Like, oh, we do too. We just don't know the timing. And, you know, we're still in this, you know, we still have a lot of humans involved in go to market. Would you want to come over here and figure it out with us? And I, Tim, was like, I do. That's exactly what I want to do. Because I want to write a book. I want to teach a class. I want to kind of decode for the rest of the world, not just the inside baseball kind of software world that already kind of knows PLG, but the rest of the world. Like, I was on the board of Forrester at the time. Sorry for all the storytelling, Tim, but I was on the board of Forrester, and I told my colleagues, like, I think I'm going to go write a book on PLG. And they're like, oh, that sounds great. What does that stand for? I'm like, wow, what? Like,
you even teach a class, an MBA class on PLG, right?
Yeah.
And
yeah.
I totally forgot that in the intro.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, this is all happening at the time. Like, in 2022, I'm calling BYU. I'm like, hey, I'd like to stop teaching B2B sales and marketing and start teaching PLG. And same question, like, well, what does PLG stand for? Product-led growth. Okay, what does that mean? I'm like, wait a second. Like, an MBA program doesn't know it. The board of Forrester doesn't know it. Like, we all think that it's just like a thing because we hear it all the time. But the world, like the economy, the capital E, doesn't understand it yet. We got to write that book. So I sit down with Mark Roberge. He's like, yeah, that book hasn't been written. The book that brings PLG to the masses, to the capital E economy, to Wall Street, to, you know, to Forbes, that book hasn't been written. You should write it. I'm like, yeah, I think I'm going to write it. So I joined Winning by Design. We're working on that stuff. We're bringing these models together. We're figuring out kind of first principles, not just for how to start a company on PLG. I do cover that. You know, let's take the lessons from Atlassian and Twilio and Dropbox. Okay, got it. But also, how do you retrofit PLG into an existing business, which is what HubSpot and MongoDB did, and then how to think about kind of adaptations of PLG, even in kind of enterprise software businesses or non-software businesses. So kind of the whole spectrum.
I see. And so now you consult mainly companies with ARR north of 50 million, or what do we need to, or how do we need to see that?
So winning by, that is indeed Winning by Design's ideal customer profile, kind of 50 million to 2 billion, mostly private equity owned, mostly, you know, dealing with issues of scaling, you know, growth and scaling, Tim. All of those companies have to hit rule of 40. And, but it's not, but you can't get 40 points all from profitability. You will never, that is not the, that's not the recipe for success. You got to get at least 20 of those points from growth, even when you're big. So those growth and scaling issues, and a lot of times when you get to that stage, Tim, like you start hitting kind of an attenuation point that where just like the bigger you get, the harder it is to grow. And that's because you didn't put the right growth architecture in, or you've got some kind of operational debt, you've got some sort of friction that's kind of keeping you back. So Winning by Design really focuses on those things, and AI and PLG are parts of that, but also just systematizing your growth can help. South of 50 million, even south of 10 or sorry, 20 or 10, that's kind of more, that's a domain where, you know, entrepreneurs are really iterating, learning from each other. You know, they're not hiring big consulting firms at that point. There's an active, as you know, you're in that space, advisory culture, and we're just learning and iterating as we go towards PMF and go to market fit. Mm-hmm. I love that space too. I'm less involved now there, but once in a while I do get involved.
Yeah. So you said it right. So we are basically talking to founders south of 10 million ARR. And therefore, yeah. I would love to extract the knowledge that you apply to those bigger companies that can be applied to those companies and to those founders that we talk quite regularly. So, but later, a few questions more in regards to that.
Okay.
So I was wondering, and that is also often actually an interesting question to agencies and consultants, like what are the cases where you got booked, but you quickly realized that actually you are not the right person for this problem to solve at the moment? So, or do you say it's basically always going down to the GTM, or have you seen basically cases where you say, okay, it's not my deal here?
Yeah. All the time, Tim. And I had to learn that the hard way. I have taken gigs where I've taken money that I probably shouldn't have, where like I'm like pushing my agenda, but it's not exactly what that founder needs. And that doesn't feel good at all. Like, especially as a, you know, as a founder myself and, you know, just looking that founder in the eyes and really feeling what he or she is feeling and what they're dealing with. And then, you know, and then selling them something different, like doesn't feel good at all. So, you know, you do that like once and you're like, nah, I'm not doing that again. Like, this isn't about the money. This is about helping people succeed. It's about, it's about innovation and creativity and like courage. And, so for me, I want that. I just want that match to be spot on. Then what I'm personally good at is helping a CEO see the forest for the trees, helping them with investment decisions, sequencing decisions, hiring decisions, fundraising decisions, and many, many times helping them kind of screen out the noise. Because a lot of people will tell you, I think you're a founder, like a lot of people will tell you what they believe is most important. And many of those people, especially if they're investors, have a self-interest And many times you get advice that's just not going to work, not going to help you scale. It might be a short-term sugar rush, like maybe there's an M&A opportunity, or maybe there's an opportunity to take a really big check from a customer who's then going to insert a nose ring and drag you around for 2 years telling you what to do. These things, they feel good in the short term, but they're almost like a sugar rush, and they don't help you build scalability in the long term. So if I can square off with the CEO and help her make decisions like that and help her avoid some of the mistakes I've made in the past, that's my best value add. Many people think of me as a growth advisor, and that's great, but I'm not the roll up your sleeves, let's get into your data and let's figure out how to implement, you know, a self-service onboarding flow. I have a great network of people who can do that. But what I will do is help you understand when that makes sense and not waste money on it before or after, and not wait too long.
That sounds good. That's what I wanted to hear, actually.
Yeah.
So let's talk about your book. You said you want to write a book about PLG, and this book hasn't been written. And I just got signed up for the pre-order on Amazon for your book. It's coming out next week, right?
Next week. I've got like, let's see, where is it? I have advanced copies here, so I'm like finally have my hands on it. But yeah, it'll ship next. If you pre-ordered it, you'll get it next week.
Nice, cool. Even in Germany?
I hope so. They've got, it's being sold through Waterstones and other kind of UK outlets. Okay. I'm guessing that Amazon has it in their local warehouses. I'm not 100% sure about that, but I hope you get it next week, Tim.
Yeah, cool. Looking forward to it. But talking about that book, and I mean, we all know this book
yes.
by Wes Bush, and it's called Product Led Growth. And
yeah.
So what do you bring to the conversation around PLG here? So I'm really curious, like what comes on top? Obviously, the world is different than when Wes Bush has written this one. But what did you take on that?
Well, huge love and shout out to Wes. I think Wes is one of the kindest and most professional people in the industry.
And he's been on our podcast before as well. So go back to our archive and check it out.
You can confirm that. Yeah, he's just a great guy, right? And he broke a lot of ground with that book. And I have used that book year after year. So as I mentioned in like 2021, I started teaching PLG to MBAs at Brigham Young University, and I've been using his book every year. I think his tactics are great. I think the way he kind of lays it out is really easy to understand. I even got Wes's permission to use his bowling alley framework in freemium. So, but the book that hadn't been written that Mark, you know, encouraged me to write was kind of taking those tactics and contextualizing them in the framework of like an overall growth journey that goes beyond the startup phase. It goes beyond getting to kind of product market fit and initial go-to-market fit. So now let's think about things like, you know, and these books have, especially from a tactic standpoint, these books have been written too, like around product-led sales. But let's contextualize kind of each of those things inside of an overall growth journey. Let's think about how that applies to enterprise as well as kind of pure self-service models. Let's think about how to apply product-led tactics to things other than acquisition. And then let's think about how that extends beyond software into even non-software parts of our lives. So that's kind of the capital E economy that Mark was talking about. Like, these are not concepts that should be constrained to Silicon Valley or even should be constrained to startups. These are concepts, you know, like growth teams and iteration and cohort management and GTM design. These are things that can and should be designed into all businesses. And I believe, Tim, you brought it up already, I believe AI is making that even more true and accelerating and just continuing that trend in an even more defined way.
This episode is sponsored by Rewardful. Looking for new ways to find customers for your SaaS business? Consider building an affiliate program. Rewardful is the easiest affiliate tracking platform to set up, manage, and scale for SaaS companies. Building a successful affiliate program can be a little bit intimidating at first, and that's why Rewardful has taken what they've observed from their most successful customers' affiliate programs and distilled that into an exclusive online course. The exciting part? Their affiliate marketing course is absolutely free. Start the course at academy.rewardful.com. Academy.rewardful.com. And turn your biggest fans into your best marketers.
We get to AI in a bit, but what do you see as the biggest misconception? Because we are also focused heavily on PLG companies, but what is the biggest misconception you see founders often have when it comes to PLG?
There's a very black and white kind of thing. I can only imagine that AI is going to help iron this out, Tim, but a lot of founders who I talk to who know what PLG is will say, oh yeah, we're not PLG. And then you kind of click into their brain and it's like, because we have salespeople. Okay, that's fine. Like, it's not an either or thing. This is really literally just about how do we make it as easy as possible for our customers to buy from us and to use our products. So we're trying to channel empathy. Like, so because you have salespeople, you don't need empathy. Because you have salespeople, you don't need your product to be easy to discover and activate and use. Because you have salespeople, you don't need your product to be easy to upgrade, to renew, to expand. None of those things should be true. Like, we want to make it easy to use across the board. So what we can do, what we should do, is just not make it an either or. Think about the things that you could make easier, that you could make self-service. Even for the largest companies in the world and the most cumbersome software in the world, like just think like SAP, they're building self-service right now into their product where they can. Mm-hmm. And to me, like, forget about PLG, just call it self-service or call it ease of use or call it, call it self-service. I like self-service. Where can I build that in?
Those are also the examples where we have seen the biggest success, actually. We acquired companies with very lean teams, so 1 to 3 people, which were completely 100% self-serve PLG companies. And then we worked on the fundamentals, like adding a little bit more on top of what the founder have already successfully built. And then we brought in a small sales team, and then basically like inbound sales, just nurturing those leads that were coming in. And that is where you can really do add a lot of value to those companies. And that's actually, so I can totally confirm what you're saying here. So that's good to hear.
So a company that has a self-service acquisition motion, which fine, I can let people continue on that. But once in a while, I'll add a sales assist to it to help it be close into a bigger footprint. Correct. Amazing. Yeah. Love that.
So let's actually go to the AI topic. And because that's like, I can't wake up in the morning without basically having my feed full of new AI stuff. And it's super exciting. So how is AI changing now our historic GTM playbook, and what does it mean for PLG actually?
So when you made you kind of drew a parallel earlier to just my history moving to Silicon Valley and discovering kind of this consumerization trend with enterprise, you know, quote unquote enterprise software. One of the, and this word has come up already, but one of the things that I discovered at that point that has never left my brain, Tim, is this concept of empathy. And it's made it into some, you know, books that I think every founder should read. It's often called empathy, but like if you read 4 Steps to the Epiphany or the Lean Startup, like it really is about understanding the end user. Or you read Competing Against Luck by Clayton Christensen. That's one of the books where he really leans into the jobs to be done framework. I really want to understand my user, not my buyer, but my user. And what is the job to be done that she has? How does she make progress against that job? And when would it make sense for her to hire my product to help her make progress? And that mindset.
That's just being made easier to do that with using AI, you're saying?
Exactly. Exactly. Yeah. So if I'm thinking in that way, then how can AI help it be easier? then AI is just an acceleration of all the things that we already know can kind of speed up GTM. And actually AI can penetrate parts of the market that were previously hard to do with PLG because the products were so complex. So if I need to do, like, for instance, a configuration of a complex product, could I imagine that an AI agent could help me do that better than some sort of a scripted kind of PLG flow? Of course it could. And then what we need to do is make sure that AI always shows up in as empathetic and human a way as possible. Limitations to that, as you said in the intro. And if it does, then we're doing the right thing with AI. If it doesn't, then we're in the uncanny valley where AI is trying to take on more than it really should, and it's just not going to work. But if we're channeling empathy and we're using AI to help make the experience better, easier, as you said, then we're doing the right thing.
Got it. But so, I mean, your freemium model is really compelling, but AI inference costs are real. And like, what does it mean now? So would I actually need to restrict a bit my product a little bit more because there are real costs assigned to it? I can't just send 1,000 users to my product, which sends basically uses credits on the LLMs because
it's, yeah, we're just really burning tokens, and giving it away for free and then paying for the tokens to serve them. Like, that doesn't work. One entrepreneur that I'm advising right now is working on that exactly. I go over kind of three primary monetization models in the freemium book, and there's all sorts of variations, Tim, but I think in the case where you have a non-zero marginal cost of delivery, which is true with AI because I have to pay for tokens, I have to go down like a free trial. If I'm going to do anything kind of free, it has to be bounded, to your point. There's got to be a limitation. So it's got to be a free trial where they experience the impact, but then there's an expiration date and then they have to pay. And I got to be really careful about unit economics on that because I can't give away the farm during that free trial. Maybe I can't even do a free trial. Maybe I have to charge some sort of a marginal cost from the beginning. But none of that means that I can't make it easy. None of that means that I can't make it self-service. It just means I got to think about my monetization model very carefully, because a free forever version doesn't work when I have a non-zero marginal cost of delivery.
Yeah. So what I refer to in my intro, like, if AI is taking over more and more, and I mean, it's already possible to do AI sales calls with AI, onboarding calls with AI. Your customer service or agents are partially replaced by AI agents. Like, but you are talking about empathy, and like, isn't the human touch being lost then? And that makes it harder to actually really focus on the user and what the user wants to get out of your product.
Yeah. There's a book called by Will Guardia called, what's it called? Unreasonable Hospitality. Yeah, it's fine. Unreasonable Hospitality. And this is all about the hospitality industry. So restaurants and hotels, et cetera. And to paraphrase him, he says, we want to systematize the predictable so we can humanize the exceptional. And that, I believe we can take, literally lift and shift that from his world of hotels and restaurants into our world of software. Anything that's predictable, we should systematize. We should just make it flow. Just make it flow. Just make it super easy. Don't insert a person when I don't need a person. Like, if I can just click to renew, let me just click to renew. Don't force me to talk to somebody. If I can just click to activate, let me click to activate. Don't force me to talk to someone. If I can get help from a robot at 11:30 at night in Farsi, good. Let me get help from a robot at 11:30 at night in Farsi. Like, don't force me to go speak to someone who doesn't speak my language, or force me to speak during business hours. Those are all great empathetic kind of uses to systematize the predictable. But there are times when it's not predictable, it's going to be exceptional. And that's when I really need a human touch. So one of my favorite leaders in this space is a guy named Rob Giglio, who's the chief customer officer for Canva. And he says it should be the customer's choice when she wants to talk to a robot, when she wants to talk to a human, or when she just wants to get her hands on the product. And we should let her shift lanes at her discretion. So we cannot eliminate human touch. In fact, human touch is the number one thing that's going to be kind of separate ourselves and give us that kind of unreasonable hospitality experience. But we need to give the human the choice. Like, if she just wants to click through and get her hands on the product and work with it, let her do that. If she wants to get help from somebody at 11:30 at night, let it be a robot. And if she needs to have that exceptional experience, let's show up as a human and do what only humans can do, with kind of true, you know, Tim, not, you know, true human empathy and true, I mean, there are real considerations, especially when you get bigger, with stakeholder management and alignment of incentives and budget acquisition, that really are going to take a human to human negotiation. Robots are not going to take that piece of it over. Humans are uniquely positioned to that. So let's have them doing that, not processing renewals that could be reasonably automated.
Understood and signed. When we talk about AI and GTM, I think one topic, actually Monday.com surprised us last week in the investors call, where they even, basically a quote, or they mentioned that their organic search is dropping because of AI overviews not sending the traffic anymore from Google to their website. So it's basically affecting the left side of the bow tie funnel. What do you say to that? Like, is that an excuse for bad SEO work, or is it real? Do you see that? And how do you tackle this challenge now?
Let me flip it on you. When you're searching for new information, where do you go?
No, Gemini, ChatGPT, for sure.
Me too. Like, it's just so much easier, right? And you have to go validate it and follow the links, but that initial kind of like, just tell me what the wisdom of the internet has. It's way easier to get from an LLM. So I bet I'm glad that Monday.com was able to own that. I'm sure the next day they were like, oh my gosh, what did we do wrong? Cause of the drop in stock price. But they're just calling it like they see it. And if they're being honest about it and trying to navigate into the future, I think in the end, it'll work out great for them. I do think there's a fundamental shift. Like, you and I both in our personal lives, we're using Gemini or ChatGPT or Claude for discovery. Like, I am. Like, if I want to know reviews of a certain vendor or reviews of a certain product, that's where I go. I'm like, what's the general consensus about this product? And I'll get a general feeling, and then I'll go validate that with kind of real user reviews. But that's where I go. And I think everyone's doing that. So I think now what we have to do is figure out how to leverage, like, what are the sources that LLM is drawing on in order to provide that information? And then for our own kind of SEO, we got to go populate those sources. And I know that that sounds really kind of mechanical and growth hackery, but, you know, we used to do kind of a lot of content marketing for Google. Now we got to do a lot of content marketing for LLMs, and we just got to understand how LLMs work and optimize our use of that.
Mm. Yeah. So, may I ask what tools you see for tracking that?
I haven't seen any tools yet. There's a couple of agencies out of New York, and I don't remember the names, Tim. We can put those in the show notes too. I'll look them up. But a couple of agencies in New York that are trying to, one agency in New York and another one, I can't remember, Eastern Seaboard somewhere in the US, that's trying to reverse engineer that. So they'll run kind of like thousands of questions through an LLM. They'll figure out the results. I think they're using Gemini mostly for it because they can get the source material. And then they'll kind of reverse engineer that and say, oh my gosh, in this domain, most of the wisdom of the LLM is coming from Reddit. Therefore, if you want to rank, you know, in this domain for an LLM, you need to have a decent amount of content on Reddit, or it might be like a specific industrial kind of review site or some other specific sources. They're literally just trying to trace that back, but I haven't seen any tools for it yet, like SEMrush or SEO Moz or anything like that.
So we have luckily our SEO, now called SEO and GEO team, that is following the space very closely and also consulting our companies. And we even have one company that has now expanded their product capabilities from Google rank tracking to AI visibility tracking, which is keyword.com.
Smart.
So happy to make an intro so you can check it out.
Then I think there's arbitrage there. Given that there are no tools, Tim, like I think there's arbitrage available there now. Like if you can go own the LLM space, you probably can't own it forever, but right now it's cheaper than it will ever be if you can hack it and figure it out.
Yeah, for sure. And I think that that's also kind of the beautiness at the moment. And that is something that brings me a lot of value. In the past, for example, I paid $50 for a WordPress plugin rank directory tracker. So I wanted to see if our plugin ranks for certain keywords. Now I build it with Lovable and n8n together in a few minutes. And now I have my own and I only pay Lovable the $20 or $50 per month. And now I can even apply to Atlassian store. I can apply to the Shopify plugin store. So now it's like super easy for me to come up, although I can't code myself. And that is a complete game changer for me. And
so cool. What a world we live in.
Exactly. So we're running over time a bit, but maybe two closing questions. As you know, I'm supporting our M&A team to evaluate marketing teams, marketing orgs, when we look into companies. So what would you advise me to look at to spot if a company is set up for the now changing world? What would you look at when looking into a company you would like to acquire?
Well, two things that are, venture investors talk about market, team, and product, right? Big market, talented team. I think in that order, and product that's meeting a need or that over time we think can meet a need. I don't think any of that's changed. I definitely want a big market. Depending on how much capital I want to deploy, it doesn't have to be a giant market. It could be, a cash efficient medium market, but I need to have a real market for the product, and I need to have a team that's super talented. I want to look them in the eyes. I want to see that they have courage and that they have natural curiosity. I also want to see that they, are willing to kind of architect their way into a scalable business, not fake their way into a scalable business. There's a lot of false positives that historical entrepreneurs, some of whom are now advisors, would tell you to pay attention to because it worked for them. The easiest one is we raised a big round. Who cares? That is a false positive. Like, do not pay attention to that. Or we sold one big customer. Who cares? That does not mean that you have a repeatable business. Or even we have a high growth rate. Who cares? I want to see that growth rate is made up of repeatable and economically sustainable units. Sometimes I call it stackable growth. I want every one of those units of growth to have been acquired in the same way. Like, I would much rather have 50 $5,000 customers than one $2.5 million customer. That's way more repeatable and sustainable business. So I'm going to look into repeatability and unit economics. And then I want to know that the CEO has that mindset, that builder, first principles, kind of mechanical flywheel mindset, because I think that is now going to scale versus I'm going to go chase big logos or big kind of one-time events and then brag about being, a market leader. That let somebody else go buy that company. You go buy the one that's scaling predictably.
Yeah, that sounds good. Last question. So we have internally the Slack channel. It's called Potential Acquisitions Checker. You can just type in any domain and an AI basically runs a check and tells us how likely this is a good company to look at and to talk to. Do you have any small, tiny SaaS product in mind that you maybe use on a daily basis, what you would suggest me to type to paste into that channel so I get some kudos from our M&A team?
Well, I'm a little scared to see what comes back, but a company I'm advising, Pledge.2, might be interesting. It's they're taking over where GoFundMe kind of left off, and they're bridging into kind of nonprofit fundraising. I built a company in that space too, but I think Pledge is doing a better job than I did. So check it out. See what it comes back with.
We'll do, and then I send you a PM what came out.
Yeah, yes. Keep it very private. I want to love it.
Dave, that was a great time talking to you. Thank you so much.
Jawohl, danke schön, Tim.
Oh, wow.
Na, ich kann ein bisschen Deutsch, ja. Du bist Deutscher, nicht?
Ja, genau.
Jawohl.
So let me know, ping me when you're in Germany next time or in Europe.
Do it.
We'll make sure to have a drink together. There are quite exciting SaaS conferences here. So if you make it, let me know.
Let's do it. I'm in October. I'm in London and then in Ghent. Maybe we could make Germany happen too.
Cool. Let's do that.
As part of the book tour for freemium. Thank you so much for having me, Tim.
Thank you. And have a great day.
Love it.
That was yet another awesome conversation on SaaS Unbound. We're always looking for new guests to share their experiences. We mostly talk with bootstrapped SaaS founders, and if you're one, reach out to me directly at anna@saas.group or find me on LinkedIn. If you're not bootstrapped or even not SaaS but have a great story to tell, we want to hear from you too. And obviously, SaaS Unbound wouldn't be possible without the SaaS Group, a founder-friendly private equity company that buys awesome businesses that people love to take them to even greater success. If you're thinking about selling your company or just exploring your options, feel free to visit saas.group, fill in the form, and expect a response in under 24 hours.